so, to the complex. Or rather, it whistled and hooted, and the black square in its chest spoke a second later. The complex? Daffod echoed. Where the work is done, it replied, as if that answered the question. The work? Soon, soon, the librarian said, patting at the air with one of its mantis-like forearms. The gesture was eerie because it seemed almost human, like the thing had learned how the primates of Ajian used their bodies well enough to mimic them, but not so well that the movement seemed natural. Other groups passed in the corridor. He recognized some. Rakhund, that had murdered people in the invasion, Soft Lothark, jailers from the ship. Others were unfamiliar. A flock of hand-sized globes that floated and swam through the air in a chorus of ticking that might have been something about their method of flight, or might have been a conversation. A thing that looked like someone had crossed an ape with a crow, that stood alone in the corridor with its face to the wall. A thick black animal that could almost have been a dog, but with a mouth that opened vertically, set between far too many eyes. And the wide-bodied Kharriks themselves, lumbering along on their massive forearms, with their abdomens skittering behind to keep up. The librarian turned, then started down a gently sloping ramp. Ricker caught Jessen's eye and tried a smile. The smile she gave back was quick and small, and her eyes flicked away at once. He felt as embarrassed as if he'd asked her to come to bed with him and had her laugh at the thought. That wasn't her fault. He wasn't at his sanest. When Hel came to Ajian, he'd been with a group of his old friends from Dian Academy. Some he'd followed from the cafe where he'd first learned about the things that Samar Austad hadn't lived to see. Some were part of the gathering they'd gone to join. Else, bless her, had offered him a place in her basement, but that had seemed like a terrible idea. He'd made his excuses and stayed where he was. All of them, Ricker included, had been either drunk or otherwise altered by the time the grid appeared in the sky and the voice had followed it. He'd been outside, sitting around a fire pit with an older woman he'd known on and off for years and her precocious 10-year-old son. The memory of her seeing the uncanny brightnesses in the sky and treating them like a great treat as a way to keep her child from panicking hurt Ricker now. She'd died in the first strike. Three others in the group had as well. A single loud sizzle, like someone had overloaded an electrical circuit, and they'd collapsed, the air smelling of distant lightning. One of them had screamed, but only once. He could still see the blood pouring out of her side where the exit wound gaped. He could still see her son's eyes widening. Irina touched his forearm, and he flinched, but he was back in the corridor with the alien monsters. How terrible that should be a better place than his memories. "You're all right?" the young woman asked softly. "Sure, fine," he said. "Thank you." She nodded once sharply before moving back to Jessen's side. Ricker shoved his hands in the rotting remains of his pockets and lowered his eyes. He felt himself on the edge of a kind of sensory overload. He felt that way often. The corridor broadened, the ceiling rising away into a cathedral-tall space. Vast, dark walls towered higher than the tallest buildings at Irvian, lines of brightness and dark covering them like calligraphy in some unimaginable script. Archways where the walls met the floors seemed like decorative flourishes until they came close to them and saw they led to alcoves tall enough that Ricker couldn't have touched the ceiling with his outstretched hand. Huge windows high above in the cathedral space let in what appeared to be natural light. Wide, white beams cutting through a haze of dust. A dozen or more species chittered and sang, moved through the broad central space or squatted in it, in groups like undergraduates having a picnic by the duck pond. The far side of the chamber felt like it was almost too far away to see. The air smelled weirdly like a forest, rot and wet and growth and decay. There was something else about it, too, an energy in the atmosphere, a brightness, like the air itself was easier to breathe. "What the hell is this?" Tanner said. "This is for you," the librarian said, its reedy, machine-mediated voice somehow managing to be warm and reassuring. "Your place is this way." It gestured with the thinner pair of forearms. "This way." The alcove it led them toward had a band of red across the top that reminded Ricker of the old Galatian parable about spreading a blood offering over the doorway of a house as a sign of faith that made the demons pass it by. The alcove itself was like a deep side chamber off the bedlam of what Ricker already thought of as the public square. Counters stood at the height of workbenches, but made from something like fiberglass or hard ceramic and attached immovably to the walls. There were a series of complications on the benches. One that could have been a centrifugal sampling unit, another that looked like some kind of off-brand CCA resonance imager. A screen that had the menu script of the proteomic dictionary they had used back at the Irvian Research Complex in some previous lifetime. Salvage from Agian, torn out of whatever building they'd been in and brought here, just as they had been. The librarian shuffled around, surprisingly agile for something as huge as it was. "This is a laboratory," Tanner said. "This is our laboratory, from home." "Functionally," the librarian agreed. "The details are approximate. But we believe that all of the work you did there can be continued here." "Why?" Jessen asked. Her voice had an awed tone that made Ricker wonder if she was aware she'd spoken. A small brown creature with vast yellow eyes and something equal parts fur and feathers covering its body scurried in, looked at them all, and scurried back out. The librarian moved deeper into the alcove, and they followed. A turn in the alcove's back had obscured another structure, and the team gathered around it like students taking a guided tour through a museum. "Here is a display of ancient art. Here are the skulls left from long past atrocities pulled out of their graves for your edification." Ricker moved forward too, trying to see better, and then back. He felt hungry and nauseated at the same time. The cages were cubes of clear material, glass or plastic or transparent ceramics, and a little over waist high. In one, a cluster of red orbs clung to a stick, shifting slightly as though they were ruffled by some unfelt breeze. In the other, a wide, flat creature lurched about on three stumpy legs. Its body was an iridescent blue that flashed to vibrant red when the light struck it at certain angles. It reminded Ricker of a turtle that was missing a quarter of itself. The librarian gestured toward the bright red orbs, berries, eggs, fungal growths, whatever they were. "These are from one of our subject worlds. This," it pointed to the not turtle, "is from another. You will make these first organisms nourishing for the second." The librarian shifted its mass away, making more room for them in front of the cages. The others surged forward. Most of the others. Daffod Alcor kept back the same way Ricker did, though probably for different reasons. The younger man was scowling and glancing back toward the mouth of the alcove like there was something there he'd forgotten. The research team, though, were packed close to the cages and the samples. Tanner stood in the center of the group, Else at his side, commanding the little space with his body the way he always had. "These are from different planets?" Tanner asked. "Different evolutionary trees?"
"Yes," the librarian said.
"Do they match either of the biomes from Ajian?" Tanner asked. There was already a sense of authority coming into his voice. "Are these known structures, or are we starting from scratch?"
"An important question," the librarian agreed without answering.
Irina pushed down on the cage with the red orbs, and it clicked, the top rising open on a hinge that Ricker couldn't see even as he saw it working. The smell that came out was like incense and fresh-turned earth, spicy and rich.
"You are permitted as many samples of the organisms as are of use. We have duplicated your supplies from your former laboratory. If you have other needs, I will consider them."
Jessen was reaching in to stroke the red orbs. They shifted on their stick, neither moving toward her nor away from her. Ricker wondered whether they knew they were food.
"What if we don't do it?"
That was Alcor. He had moved back to lean against the opposite wall. The librarian had to turn to look at him, his bulk scattering the rest of the group. Else stepped in, moving physically between the thing and the young man.
"Or if we can't, this isn't a small project. Generalizing two whole biomes from single samples and then reconciling them? If it's more than we can manage."
The librarian planted its two massive forelegs on the ground, leaning forward on them to let its hindquarters dance from side to side in agitation. For a moment, it seemed to be at a loss for words.
"This is your task," it said.
"What about these other creatures?" Daffod asked. "Are they being tested too? This same test?" The librarian's answer came quickly this time.
"The only test is whether a subject species is useful. Usefulness is survival."
They were all silent for a moment. The implications of the simple statement were like ice water in Ricker's blood. Kampar chuckled.
"Come on, that's pretty much what every funding committee says."
No one laughed. The path back to the rooms felt shorter than the walk out had been. Ricker had noticed that before in other, less exotic circumstances. The first walk through a new neighborhood, the first commute in a new city, the first time finding his way to a new address to meet someone, and the anxiety of walking with them to a cafe that he was only halfway sure he could find. First times always expanded the experience of the space for him. Going back was faster, the distance shorter, because it was known. When they got back, Sinia still sat exactly where she'd been when they left, her hands folded in her lap. The others had fallen into conversation, so he went to her, asked which of the rooms were taken and which he could lay claim to. She showed him, and he picked the door farthest from the others. He showered awkwardly, startled by the blast of red fluid, then luxuriating in the warm water that followed. The bruises on his back had faded, but he could still feel them, and his ribs ached when he breathed too deeply. He washed his hair and shaved, and tried to remember what he could about the psychology of trauma. He'd read a book about it once, but it had seemed like abstract knowledge at the time. The clothing that the aliens had left for him fit well enough, but he could still wish for a decent jacket and a pair of soft shoes.
When he reached the common room again, cleaner and fresh-faced, apart from the scab on his neck, softened by the shower and bleeding, he found that the others had hauled the couches and chairs and cushions into a rough circle, a little oblong, really, with the apex of the curve focused on Tanner. Another thing that hadn't changed. He went to the kitchen, where a pot of something that looked and smelled like soup simmered on a thermal pad. It had an aroma like beef and fresh ginger, and nothing had ever smelled better. No one objected when he took a bowl and a spoon and helped himself. After the near tasteless paste he'd survived on during the journey, the depth and richness was intoxicating. He listened to the others talking as he took stock of the pantry. Fruit and frozen meat, loaves of bread that had been kept cold enough that they were still thawing, fresh vegetables, but nothing leafy. Whatever the Carracks used to keep food from rotting on the way from Ajian was good enough for pea pods, but lettuce was apparently a bridge too far. "He didn't say life or death," Irina said, gesturing with a single raised finger in a way that suggested she'd been interrupted before and was getting irritated. "He said there was only one test. Being deemed not useful doesn't have to mean some kind of summary execution. Maybe not useful species are sent home." "They killed an eighth of our population just to get our attention," Kampar said dryly. If Sinia had been there when the conversation began, she was elsewhere now. That was probably wise. Ricker leaned against the counter and ate, close enough to be part of the group and also not claiming his place in it. "It doesn't matter," Tanner said. He was a little wild around the eyes. Fear, Ricker thought. Well, fair enough. They were all frightened, but something else too. Excitement, maybe, or the drive that made his work group a thing worth hauling across the stars. "Maybe they kill us. Maybe they ship us back home. Maybe something else. I don't care. And you shouldn't either, because we're not going to fail. This is what we do, and we are going to do the hell out of it." Jessen's little nod was almost subliminal. Ricker found himself more moved by Tanner's resolve than he'd expected to be. He remembered something he'd read when he was young and thinking he might go into the military. A leader must be utterly decisive, especially when giving orders that conflict with the ones from the day before. He didn't recall who'd said it, but he had the sense it was some famous leader. He hadn't understood it then. He did, maybe, now. The others grabbed on to Tanner's certainty like it was an umbrella and they were caught in a hailstorm. Ricker watched their bodies shift into calmer, more familiar postures. "I was looking at the food organism," El said. "It didn't seem like it was growing out of the stick. I think those are different things." "Maybe the red berries feed on the stick," Jessen said. "If they do, that's going to give us two organisms from their biome." Tanner snapped his fingers and pointed at Else, grinning. Ricker felt himself smiling along. It was a good insight. It felt like an accomplishment, and an accomplishment felt like a little sip of power in an ocean of powerlessness. Nothing could be normal, but work could sustain them. Across the room, Daffod was leaning against the window, arms crossed, and the huge expanse of the clouds, arches, and terraced pyramids at his back. Ricker would have expected him to be more engaged, but he seemed to be listening with half an ear at most. Ricker wondered what was distracting him, but then the conversation shifted and distracted him instead. "We take rolling shifts," Tanner said. "Always someone in the lab. No downtime in the project, and no one collapses from exhaustion." It didn't look like there were enough workstations for more than two or three people to be in the lab anyway. "Whoever's not there does theory work here." "And eats and sleeps," El said. "Yes,"
Tanner agreed. Those things, very important. Ricker chuckled, and felt a little bloom of affection for the man. Whatever you thought of Tanner Fryce, he was utterly himself.
We'll need something to take notes with, Kumpar said. We're undersupplied in the notebook department.
Tanner pointed at him now.
We'll figure that out.
We can work in pairs, Jessen said.
You and Arina, Tanner said, as if it had been his idea. Else and Kumpar. I'll take Daffod.
Are you sure? Else said. You and Kumpar have a chemistry sometimes. I don't mind doing the follow-on work if you'd rather.
One senior researcher, one assistant. Jessen, you just got a field promotion. Congratulations, Tanner said. And I've got the most experience, so I'll take Daffod. Keep it close to even.
Else sat back, her arms crossed and a little mark of concern on her brows, but she nodded. Ricker tipped back his bowl, swallowing the last of the broth. It had grit at the bottom that tasted like dirt from heaven, savory and thick and pepper hot. The ceramic clicked when he put it on the counter.
I suppose, he said, that puts me with Sinia.
The sudden quiet was eerie. They all turned to him. Irina was the first to look away.
When you were in the showers, Jessen said, then lost what she was going to say and tried again. Sinia said she's not going to participate.
Ah, Ricker said.
Well, I can sign on as jack of all trades. Fill in wherever a hand's needed.
You can stay in your room and out of my way, Tanner said.
Ricker's laugh was like a cough. It wasn't funny.
You can't be serious.
I couldn't trust you when the stakes were low, Tanner said. Why the fuck would I trust you now?
Chapter 14. Ekor of the cohort Taklal was subjugator librarian for the 16th dactyl of the third limb of the 20th exploratory body. The librarians of the other ships of the dactyl gave their information and reports to it and accepted direction and instructions from it, just as it, in turn, relayed those things of importance to the subjugator librarian of the third limb. Like nerve fibers in flesh or void tendrils in asymmetric space, the librarians coordinated the actions of the sovereign's will. A vast network of judgment and obedience that splayed across thousands of stars. Its present action was the conquest and subjugation of a small world in the diffuse space between two galactic limbs. And as the Carrick's librarian squatted in its niche, legs folded under its abdomen, fighting limbs set against the deck and feeding limbs moving through the streams of the dactyl's signal transfer, it did not guess how badly things were about to go. The major indigenous species were land-based hexapods who called themselves something like Ili and their world Ayaye. The subjugator librarian had all the information the initial probes that had followed the void tendrils had given. The half-mind reformed and deepened the data points into something akin to insight. The Ili moved across their world in packs of 12 to 40, establishing no hives or cities, but singing to one another in waves that traveled across continents. Their atmosphere was awash in a vast world song. In the belly of the Carrick ship, nodes shuddered in their liquid wombs, ready to be born, eager. Ranks of Rakunt and soft Lothark prepared to fall through the high air of the world, bringing the word of the Carricks and the changed fate of Ayaye. The violence to come was not a victory, but a growth pang. The displacement of a species that had grown in the universe directionless and feral, discovering its purpose within the Carricks and being shaped into utility. A sign-in coordinator paused at the subjugator librarian's door, pulling its attention from the coming battle. Seeing the animal's complex eyes and facial appendages sent a cascade of disgust rippling through the Carrick's librarian, as it always did. Others among the ranks of the Empire's librarians were capable of interacting with the animal captives with equanimity. Ekur Taklal was quietly proud that it had not developed this callousness toward perversity. The Sinan burbled, and the translation half-mind at its throat took the wet, sibilant noises and turned them into language. The subjugator prime is prepared. Ekur Taklal pulled its feeding limbs from the flow of information, rose up on its legs, and went to make its final connection before the outspreading began. The prime, the highest of the subjugator caste of their dactyl, lowered itself to the deck in ritual abasement as Ekur Taklal entered its niche. Even pressed down, the prime was almost as tall as the librarian. When it rose, it towered. "We are prepared," it said. Ekur Taklal shifted its gaze across the long rows of Carrick soldiers and the animals of violence that expressed their will with a thrill of disgust. Its part now was to check for signs of irregularity and error, to match what was against what was expected, and it did this with great efficiency. When it was finished, it turned back to the prime. "Begin," the librarian said, and left. Once it returned to its niche, it expressed the intention to the other lesser librarians, who would express it to the lesser leaders in their ships. Like a fist closing around a stone, the Carricks reached out their nodes and their soldiers, the animals that announced the end of Ely history and the beginning of their service to the Carricks. The wandering troops of alien things were counted, divided in two, then two again, then two again, and the limb was chosen. 1 in 8 of all Ely died. All was moving as intended. It was only when the soldiers reached the planetary surface that unexpected things began to happen. In the planet's northern hemisphere, a collection of the Ely in the valley of a vast plain drew the attention of the prime. It directed 100 Carricks and 2,000 animals of violence to descend on the indigenous population for acquisition and subjugation. Half of their animals of violence died, and a third of the Carricks. Ekur Taklal rechecked the information, but the half-mind, passionless and incapable of meaningful surprise, remained adamant. One of the largest groups of conquering Carrick's forces had just suffered massive casualties. As the subjugator librarian narrowed its attention, searching for details from the battlefield, another group, this one in a cave complex of the southern hemisphere, blinked out. 200 animals and 6 Carricks. In an archipelago just north of the equator, where twilight was pulling the sky into shadow, 500 animals and 10 Carricks vanished. Another group, another, another. It would have been unthinkable, except that it was happening. The drone grid found the prime in transit between a half-constructed extraction center and a wide lake where several groups of Ely were shown to be nesting. The prime's voice vibrated with confusion, and something the librarian refused to believe was fear. "The species is not as the probes and void tendrils reported. We have only collected a few of them intact, but they are not from this world." "Repeat and clarify." "They are unrelated to the planetary ecosystem. Manufactured life forms intended to trick us into believing they are the indigenous species," the prime said. "This is a trap." Ekur Taklal's feeding limbs twitched, fingers plucking at each other as it thought. There was no time to consult the librarian of the third limb, no time to ask for counsel and direction. The choice needed to be made now, and as the senior librarian of this dactyl, that gave it both the burden and the power. "Return to the ships," it said. The Prime braced as Akur Taklal shifted its attention to the half-mind. The drone grid identified and destroyed the remaining Ili. 500 million more deaths in the span of moments. But the subjugator librarian was already shifting the half-mind's focus outward to the dead planets, moons, and asteroids of the system. The simple volume of a solar system made the search difficult, time-consuming. The animal transfer ships, empty of captives, were hauling themselves up through the air, and the drones in their grid were starting to wither and decohere before the librarian found what it was looking for, what it was certain would be there. A stretch of vacuum, the size of a small moon, had begun to stutter and boil. Exotic waves that the half-mind displayed as blue and gold light, though they were not light, flickered in the gap. Another rip appeared on the far side of the system's star, a third above the ecliptic. The strategic half-mind pointed out the resonance relationship between the intrusions and offered a geometric explanation for why there wouldn't be a fourth unless the existing rifts changed position. The battle had been chosen. The enemy had arrived. From the three rifts, ships began to spill out into normal space, blinking into reality from whatever non-dimension the enemy employed to undo the limits of the local universe. The strategic half-mind marked each one as it appeared, delivering something like knowledge to the librarian. 10 enemy vessels had come through each rift. The patterns of heat and light that came from them matched what the Kariks had experienced in previous encounters, with 6 exceptions. If the enemy used energy weapons that traveled at the local maximum, it would be 8 hours before the first attack would arrive. The ships themselves would take much longer. The librarian mapped the possible paths that the dactyl could employ to engage or avoid, and the strings of possibility bloomed in its mind like a terrible flower. The drones withered and fell into the atmosphere of Ayaye, burning one by one and then by the thousands. The grid collapsed unnoticed. The Ili were a sprung trap. The damage they would do was done, and the violence played out now in the void between the planets. The librarian moved a duplicate of the strategic half-mind into the body of a low-status Sinan, erasing the animal's mind in the process. The living corpse that the half-mind now inhabited would be fed into a message casing and sent through asymmetric space alone. Carrying news of the attack to the librarian of the third limb would take 7 days. If it was relayed all the way up to the regulator librarian at the center of the Empire, a reply might not come for months. Until it did, this battle belonged to Akur Taklal and whatever unknowable mind directed the limbs of their enemy. 3 weeks into the long conflict, Akur Taklal won its first victory and suffered its worst loss. The librarian of the ship that was lost sent out its last report from the 2nd-8th mark of a gas giant's gravity well, where the resonance of the huge planet and the local star created optimal conditions for a close-quarters battle. The images the lesser librarian sent, captured by the optical matrix of a Rakhund, showed the passageways of the Karak ship as the animals of the enemy flowed through them. Akur Taklal knew that the enemy was virtually deathless. that their animals of violence could be riddled with injuries and flow forward like a tide. The heat and pulse of the living organism could fade without ending its assault. Knowing this prepared it for the images, but didn't undo the mystery of how. The Carracks of the ship had led its forces in a final effort to cast the enemy back into the vacuum, and they had almost managed. The final images showed the breach, the uncanny field waves that the enemy used to weaken the ship's flesh. The enemy bled black and red and clear. Their voices were a mesh of radio signals that danced to evade all the Carrick's efforts to drown it out. Ekur Taklal watched as the enemy weapons split the air, as the Carrick's white-green battle shells cracked, as the Rakhund and Soft Lothark died in waves to push the fight a little farther from their dying masters' bodies. The ship had been lost before the word of its loss arrived. Its death was a brightness across the spectrum of energy, a sphere of irregularity in space expanding until it was indistinguishable from the vacuum itself. The incalculable loss was also an opportunity. Traveling in the skin of that detonation, hundreds of escaping enemy wrapped in shells of titanium and deep copper fled death and found captivity. The webwork of void tendril and magnetic force gathered the escape pods like a net hauling in fish. The enemy saw what was happening too late. Five of their ships turned toward the failed evacuation. When distance and the laws of the local universe kept them from rescuing their companions, they launched an attack. The deathless could still be annihilated, and the enemy would rather slip into oblivion than be yoked. The librarian understood that, and took something like pleasure in the enemy's frustration. The librarians of the remaining ships reported an increased ferocity in the enemy. Loss, it seemed, drove them to recklessness. The subjugator librarian noted this, added it to the body of knowledge that was the eternal battle. Out of more than 1,000 species, this enemy was the most recalcitrant. But the patterns in its behavior and design would bring it to heel in time, and domesticated, would add its great strength to the Empire. Enemy ships dove deep into the center of the system, skimming through the star's corona to evade the tracking eyes of the Carracks. The leaders operating the Carrack ships launched clouds of projectiles, some alive and some inert, at the enemy ships, and watched as they were unmade or evaded or, rarely, as they struck home. The disabled enemy ships flickered into knots of nuclear fire and faded to ash. Whether that was the nature of the enemy, or a choice to deny information to the Carracks, wasn't clear. With each engagement, the subjugator librarian sent another message casing to offer up its decisions and intentions to the librarians whose work was to see a larger image of the Empire in less detail, and guide the grand strategy of the war, of all the wars, of the will and intention of their species. Day after day, cycle after cycle, no direction came back, and Ekur Taklal coordinated the lesser librarians, gave shape to the will of the soldiers and their animals of violence. One of the Carrick ships stumbled into a volume of space studded with nearly invisible mines and was destroyed. Two of the enemy ships, straining to scrape away pursuing projectiles, came too close to the atmosphere of the icy fifth planet. They burned, and they fell. When a cur of the cohort Taklal had been young, it had tried to claim status over one of its siblings. The two of them had reared up in the open plain by the birthing creche, their fighting arms spread wide and flailed their adolescent strength into each other's bodies. It had hurt, but not enough to be decisive. Unsure how to approach an unfinished challenge, they had kept going, slamming their fighting arms together, each hoping to snap the other's leg. It had gone on until their creche leader had appeared and pushed them apart. The battle around Ayaye had the same bruising violence and the same frustration. When the message casing from the subjugator librarian of the third limb did appear, blinking back into symmetric space at the edge of the heliosphere and spitting out its message in a burst of stuttering radio waves, Ekur Taklal was relieved. The chain of identifications on the message was longer than it had seen before, tracing its origin back to the center of the empire and the librarians with the broadest scope. The battle that the Dactyl fought here was part of a vastly larger action, playing out across space and time in ways that Ekur Taklal would not know, because it was not called upon to know. But that context made directions that would otherwise have been strange, comprehensible. Unpleasant, but comprehensible. It summoned the ship's prime to its niche. The huge, overwatered bulk of the soldier was repulsive in one way, endearing in another. The soldier and the subjugator librarian, born of equal dignity to any other of the Kariks and imbued with the same potential, but here they were. Genetic dead ends, made to consort with animals. The gendered cohorts of the Kariks, the moieties of production and distribution and reproduction, would look down upon them both with the same contempt that Ekur Taklal felt toward this soldier and the animals it controlled. They had this one dignity left to them, dying to protect their betters. The subjugator prime bent, abasing itself. The librarian noticed for the first time that the soldier's fighting arms had stripes of red, much like its own. The feeling of kinship was brief and fleeting. It passed a series of directions to the prime, the information hovering in symbols of light, the wavelengths shimmering with nuance, specificity, and intent. The soldier rose, considering what it had been given. Its eyes betrayed confusion. "You are to prepare your soldiers and their animals for these actions against the enemy," the librarian said. "Once they are prepared, they will shift to the other ships of the Dactyl to aid in carrying them out. The captives you have taken will be brought here and will leave with me and a minimum crew." The prime's shifting stilled as it understood what it was seeing. Each of the actions was made to provoke a different kind of response from the enemy ships, and each ended with the details of the counterattack sent in a message casing. It was a profligate use of a limited resource. Most of the space within the casings would be empty, blank, and wasted. That, as much as anything else, was the message the Empire had delivered to the Dactyl. "Are we no longer trying to win?" the old soldier asked, and its whistles and rumble were plaintive. The prime was Karix, but simple-minded and emotional. The librarian understood how it had fallen to soldier caste. Removing it from the lineage of the Karix was to the benefit of the species. The same could be said of the librarian, but for different reasons. "You will observe the enemy in action and preserve those observations. We are not the only battle in the war, and if we must bend here to break them elsewhere, of course we will." "Yes, yes, I understand." The librarian chirped an idiom of the Karak's language that the half-mind would have translated as, "You can't win a fight without bruising your own limbs." A spark of what might have been anger lit the Prime's eyes. The librarian supposed, discovering that its utility to the Carricks was in the details of how it was killed, would be distressing, even for a more advanced cohort than theirs. The secondary librarians, not welcome on the one ship carrying away the captive enemy, would likely also resent the directions that it was about to give them. But the Prime bent again, and scuttled away to do as it had been told. The librarian passed the relevant directions on to the secondary librarians under it, adding its mark to the chain of identifications as it did so. Transfer boats that had been meant to carry away the elite of the Ely instead moved between the ships of the Carrick's fleet, transferring soldiers and animals to the part of the Dactyl that would remain, and bringing the enemy captives and their soft Lothar guards to the one ship that would leave. The captives were thin-bodied animals with five-fold symmetry in their hard, crusted epidermis. The half-mind had been observing them carefully, but had not yet gained context enough to communicate with them beyond the simplest levels. That was fine. There would be time enough to question them when their journey was complete. The ship that had once been the central organizing point of the 16th Dactyl of the third limb of the 20th exploratory body turned its face away from the sun, accelerating toward the edge of the heliosphere and the vast unreality of asymmetric space. Behind it, the remnants of the Dactyl probed the forces of the enemy, engaged, disengaged, danced, fought, and died. If any of the Carrick ships survived, they would rejoin the librarian later. If not, then it was better for the species that they had died. What is, is. It can be nothing else.
Chapter 15. The work was a blessing and a burden, often at the same time. Whenever Jessen couldn't sleep, she'd imagine herself dying, drowning maybe. The hurt at first, and then tunnel vision, and everything going away and never coming back. She was mortal. It was going to happen eventually. She wasn't suicidal. She was just taking comfort in the idea that no matter what, she wasn't here forever. It wasn't suicidal until she started making plans. That's what she told herself. Then, when she was calm enough, her mind blinked out, and she just didn't exist for a few hours. It wasn't really sleep, but it was similar. When she came back, there was the choice of what she was going to do. Stay where she was and try to sleep again, or else push the blanket off and live another day. The work gave her a default. She pulled herself out of bed, stood under the weird bedroom shower, dried herself off, got dressed. All the things that normal humans were supposed to do, including eating breakfast. Eggs, cured meat, citrus fruits that were starting to get a little woody but still added some acid and sweetness, a cup of fresh coffee, and walking to the lab. None of that was as hard as choosing would be, so she didn't choose. She just ran on automatic. Not thinking was almost as good as not being, a strong second best. She threw her mind into the research to get away from everything she felt, and it was so familiar, she had to believe this wasn't the first time she'd done it. When she faded into the routine, lost herself in it, she could almost convince herself she was living her old life, working in the labs with Tonner and the team, her brother waiting to talk about dinner and whoever his infatuation of the week was when she got home. Not a person slowly losing her mind. Not the chattel of aliens. It was a nice dream to live in, for a few moments each day. She and Irina relieved Else and Kampar. They took the experiments and procedures that the others had started and saw them through, then did whatever Tanner had assigned as the step to follow. It would have been easier if there had been a board or a messaging system, or paper and pens and thumbtacks. Irina had a good memory, though, and Jessen was happy to trust her. Today they were checking cellular motility along nutrient gradients. Else and Kampar had harvested tissue from the knot turtle and put it on gel sheets with plausible food supplies, simple sugars, alcohols, and soluble carbohydrates, diffused through them. If the knot turtle cells moved toward the source, it was a possible nutrient. If they moved away, it might be a toxin. If they just stayed there, and mostly they just stayed there, either it wasn't metabolically active for knot turtles, or the tissue they'd sampled wasn't motile. Jessen had been running tests like this since she was in basic education classes. Make the slime mold solve the maze. Look how smart biology was. Something as simple as mold could thread its way through the labyrinth and find the thing that would sustain it. As she stood, watching the gels, she wondered again about Gelid. Maybe he was here, in the Carrick's world city, too. Her brother could be out there, somewhere in the thousands of levels, hundreds of thousands of hallways and chambers, lost among the monsters. If she just had the right kind of mold, maybe it could show her how to reach him. Him and all the other captives of Ajian. She sure as hell didn't know how to do it. What we need is sperm, Irina said. Jessen lifted an eyebrow. If Irina was trying to act normal, she could follow suit, rise to the occasion. She smiled the way she would have if she were sane. The dating pool has thinned a bit of late. Irina rolled her eyes, then waved her fingers in a circle while she chewed on a bite of the ham and cheese sandwich she'd brought for lunch. Or pollen, spores, whatever. I mean, they're not clones. Lots of individual variation, even in the small sample we have here. So, assuming some sort of genetic mixing during reproduction, the berries are going to have some way to swap chromosome analogs. Find that, and we'll find the encoding medium. We already know the kind of patterns to look for. Aperiodicity, multiple copies, presence in all generative tissues. But if we could get sperm out of them, we wouldn't have to wash through a bunch of functional molecules. We don't know what they do, you know? I could ask them back to my room, Jessen said. Get some candles, slow music. Well, I'm not an alien stick-eating berry thing, but if I were, I'd do better if I had some perfumes or scented soaps, Jessen said. Anything other than the red glop the shower blasts at us. Makes me smell like an old hospital ward. Maybe disinfectant is the height of olfactory fashion among aliens. Jessen chuckled. Irina grinned. She might almost have been herself. Almost. There was a darkness under her eyes, and her hands were never still. When she talked, there was a bright, compact brittleness about the words, all the familiar signs of someone trying to keep their shit together. How are you? Sat at the back of Jessen's throat, waiting to be asked. How bad is this for you? Are you losing your mind? And if you're not, why aren't you? What happened to you on those ships? What happened to you before that? A chittering like the voices of lab monkeys came from the mouth of the alcove, and Jessen turned in time to see four of the little animals hauling themselves up onto the countertop. Wide, golden eyes, a brown-gold coat that split the difference between fur and feathers, each of the four about the size of an 8-year-old. God, not again, she said, moving toward the intruders. She lifted her hands, patting the air and trying to block them. No, no, bad monkey, off you go. One of the four bared dark teeth set in black gums at her, but it looked less like a threat than a complaint. The other three bounded around her, hopping from countertop to floor and back up again like they were made from springs and rubber. Irina put down her sandwich and followed them toward the back, making shooing sounds as she went. "What we really need is a door," Jessen said, "or a baby gate, something." "Out, out, out! No, all of you out," Irina said, and the three bounced back out, loping toward Jessen. One paused to look at the gels like it was curious about them, like it had notes to offer on the process. And then all four were gone, vanished back out in the cathedral-tall common space that all the alcoves shared. "Those things are annoying," Irina said. "Enthusiastic, though. Gotta give them points for peppiness." "No, I don't think I do," she said with a sigh, and popped the last bites of her lunch into her mouth. "Are they lab animals or fellow scientists?" Jessen started to laugh, then caught herself. Irina wasn't making a joke. "That's actually a really good question. Are they trying to eat our experiments or steal our data?" "We don't know anything except what the Kariks tell us, and they don't tell us anything." "It's like we've been given the most important test of our lives," Jessen agreed, "but all the questions are in secret code." "On the plus side, if we fail," Irina said, "they kill us. So no need to worry about placement rankings." While Jessen was trying to formulate a reply to that, Irina went to the protein database, tapping the input display like she was trying to get its attention. The machine chirped. "Why?" Jessen asked, meaning to ask, "Why bring us all this way and set us up for failure and death?" "This?" Irina replied, as though Jessen had asked her about her entries on the display. "It's my workaround for not having anything to write with. I've been coding in the work like it was a peptide sequence and using the error log. See?" Jessen leaned over. The little display read, "ERR, colon, mid-pH protein assay of source species, colon, bad format." "That's brilliant." "That's why we're all here," Irina said, and it was half a joke. If they hadn't all been just a little brilliant, if they hadn't been part of Tanner Fryce's work group, if the research they'd done in the past years hadn't been noticed or celebrated, maybe they'd have been back on Agion instead of in this prison. Jessen wondered what was happening back at home, whether she'd been lucky to escape, or if she was being punished for her little sip of celebrity and status. She wondered if Jellit was alive. She wondered how long she was going to be able to keep going. And here was pretty little Irina, youngest of them all, smiling and typing her notes as though anything about where they were made sense. But what else could they do? "Protein assay," Jessen said. "I'm on it. I'll tear the CCA if you make the soup." "Deal," Jessen said, and went back toward the cages. The organisms were, in their own ways, fascinating. The berries, which were profoundly not berries in anything besides size and shape, contained an order of magnitude more silicates in their chemistry than anything Jessen had seen before, and the internal structure of the little beasts, simplistic and undifferentiated as it appeared to the naked eye, was protected by a thick layer that seemed at first like epidermis. But the more she looked at it, the more it looked like a separate organism. Discovering whether this was mutualism or parasitism or a gender dimorphism thing, like a female torrent mold enclosing the male, would have to wait until they had determined the medium of genetic inheritance. But one way or another, it was actually kind of cool. She opened the transparent cage and plucked four of them out. They clung to the stick, trying to resist her, but not more than a grape would cling to its vine. They were warm in her palm and rippled a little against her skin. She carried them to the sampling array and dropped them down among the blades. White dots tracked along their skin, little foot analogues trying to find purchase in this new environment. Wherever the little animals or plants or fungi had evolved, it hadn't been a lab grinder. The skills and abilities they'd developed generation after generation under whatever alien sun they'd called home weren't going to help here. They were as helpless and out of place as she was. "Sorry, little guys," she said. "Hope you're not sentient. Try not to feel this." The room smelled good when Jessen and Rorinna returned from their work, rich and yeasty, like bread or beer. Outside the big window, the sky was turning a ruddy orange. The huge arcs of alien structure, one part building and two parts the bones of strange gods, glittered with a million other windows like theirs. The ziggurats that marched along the curve of the planet, poking their sullen bronze heads up above the clouds, were a cityscape twisted by nightmare. Starkly beautiful, but vast enough to induce vertigo. They had just left Daffodin Tonner in the lab. Else was probably sleeping, or taking a shower, or being alone for a moment. Cynia sat on one of the couches, her hands folded on her lap, her gaze fixed on nothing. In the little kitchen, Kumpar stood by the basin washing dishes. The sounds of water and plateware were comfortingly domestic. Ricker, across from Cynia, had a bowl of something green and white that he was eating with a length of bent metal, like someone had seen a knife and spoon and decided to split the difference. "What's that?" Irina asked. Ricker paused. He did that a lot these days, shying away from social contact like a dog that's been hit too many times. But he gathered himself and hoisted the bowl. "Basil and garlic pasta," he said. "The basil's a little old, but the garlic's fine. Can't complain." "Well, that sounds tasty," Irina said, brittle, sharp, trying too hard. Jessen wavered. The smart thing, the right thing, was to get some food before she went to her room. She didn't want to. She wanted to be alone with her eyes closed. She wanted the chance to not exist. It was just the small, sane part of her that forced her to the kitchen and the pot of food. She filled a bowl, took a knife-spoon thing of her own. "Do we still have eggs?" she asked. Kumpar didn't answer. She looked over at him, then put her bowl down. The big man's eyes were fixed ahead of him, his face pale and gray. He was washing a plate, just one, his movements exactly the same, repeated. "Kumpar," she said. He turned, and the plate slid out of his fingers. When it hit the floor, he screamed at the clatter, and then collapsed. "Oh," Jessen thought, "so this is finally here." The others ran over, Irina pushing into the kitchen with her hands out, grabbing for Kumpar. "What's wrong? Is he hurt? What happened?" Jessen grabbed the other woman and hauled her away. "It's okay, don't touch him," Jessen said, kneeling on the floor beside Kumpar. His breath was fast and labored, wheezing. "Kumpar, hey, it's me. Listen, you're having a panic attack, okay? It's scary, but it's going to be okay. Just listen to my voice, all right? Just follow my voice. We're going to breathe in for the count of four, then hold it for four, then let it out for four. Be empty for four, and